All right, so as I mentioned, we have been looking at building a timeline of the events of that final week of Jesus' life. We've covered a lot of material and gotten to the weekend as he and his disciples have been partaking of the Passover, and now after instituting what we've labeled the Lord's Supper, his memorial supper, and then washing the apostles' feet, we are going to continue by looking at a couple of things that happened prior to them arriving at the Mount of Olives. So if you'll go to Matthew 26, this is where we're going to get started. And Matthew and Mark's gospel are almost identical in their wording in this particular section. So I'm not going to read both of them, so we'll just go to Matthew 26 for right now. And then we'll go to Luke 22 in just a minute. So let's read this together and then we'll discuss it. The text says in verse 30, this is right after instituting the Lord's Supper, says, "And when they had sung a hymn, they went out to the Mount of Olives. Then Jesus said to them, 'You will all fall away because of me this night. For it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. But after I am raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.' Peter answered him, 'Though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall away.' And Jesus said to him, 'Truly I tell you, this very night, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.' Peter said to him, 'Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you.' And all the disciples said the same." Now, we're going to, as we move through this, incorporate Luke 22 and John 13 and to kind of get a fuller picture. So they left that room, it appears to me, and they're headed toward the Mount of Olives. Now, we've already noticed, and we'll notice this in Luke's account, but this was a custom of Jesus leading up to the Passover. It was him going out at night and praying in the Mount of Olives. And so it was part of their custom. They're going back out there late at night to offer these prayers. Well, speak of Jody and the pops up. Good to see him. So they're headed out that way, and Jesus gives this prophetic statement that you will strike the shepherd, and what happens to the sheep?
They scatter,
exactly. Keep that in mind as we move forward into the night. He is declaring to them that you're going to run away from me. You're going to, in essence, what was the statement he made earlier at dinner about the betrayer? And one of you sitting amongst us who's going to betray me. And then he goes on to say, the one who dips his hand with me into the bread, right, to grab the bread, that one will betray me. Now, they obviously at dinner don't understand that it's Judas he's speaking to. But if I could just for a minute kind of get into where they are, Jesus has said some things this evening that I'm sure perplexed them greatly. He's talked about being betrayed. He's talked now about being struck, killed, right? And John's account, I mean, he just blatantly, he comes out and says kind of that. We'll get there in a minute. And so I'm sure they're really confused and probably very worried. And so he gives a statement, and you might can see in your mind, they're all probably sitting there talking about what's going on.
Everybody but Judas. Judas knew what was going on.
And he's gone at this point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll come back to that. So hold on to that thought of him leaving already. That'll play back in later. But yeah. But this has probably been a really heavy night for them. And this kind of, later when we get to the prayer, when they're falling asleep, One thing we should at least appreciate, and not be too hard on them, it's been a long day. You're into the evening hours now. I'm sure they're very tired, plus they have this kind of heavy weight on them. And so he says that, and then Peter, being as impetuous as he always is, at least Matthew gives out that he's the first to speak up and say this. I'm not going to portray it. I'm just not going to do it. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's basically what he says. Now, one other important thing to think about, again, how do they view Jesus' kingdom?
Earthly.
And their part in it. What's earthly? And what's their part in it?
They're going to be the leaders.
Yeah. They're going to lead a revolt. They're thinking physical war. Again, why is Peter carrying a sword? It'll get used later. And just because he's the only one used it, I doubt he's the only one carrying the weapon, by the way. Y'all, again, he's the only one noted. I doubt he's the only one, by the way. But that's the kind of mindset that they're in. And so Peter says, no, I'm not going to. And then Jesus says to him, hey, Peter, before the rooster crows three times, or before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me three times. Now, if you're Peter, how are you taking this without what's coming in your mind? That hadn't happened yet. How are you taking that?
No way.
No way.
Do that.
And so just keep that in mind as you go. Luke gives us a little bit more information, and so does John. If you go to Luke 22, note what Luke adds. Now, it's shorter in text, but actually it gives us a couple of things that are not in the other ones. One other thing before we go. Matthew 26. What does Jesus say to them before Peter steps up? What does Jesus say in verse 32? Matthew 26, 32. What does he say?
But after I'm raised up, I will go before you to Galilee.
Notice that. Before it says, after I'm raised up, I will go before you to Galilee. Now, he's already said you're going to run away from me, but what does Jesus already have in mind? You're going to come back. You're going to come back. And that's what happens. So just kind of keep that in mind as we go forward. The Galilee part two, I think that's also interesting. Where did he do most of his ministry? Not in Jerusalem. In Galilee. That's where he spent most of his time. He's saying, that's where we're going to go back. So just keep those things in mind. So let's go to Luke 22. Now, in Matthew, what we have between Jesus and Peter is kind of short. But Luke's about to give us a little bit more information. If you go to Luke 22, 31, this is what the text says in English Standard. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. But I prayed for you that your faith may not fail. And when you have turned again, strengthen your brothers. And then he goes on to give us the same kind of information that Matthew does. But he adds that part at the beginning, saying that Satan is going to sift him like wheat. Now, to me, that's really scary prospect. But when we talk about sifting wheat, what are they talking about? What is sifting wheat?
We separate the chaff from the wheat, kind of flour.
Yeah, so when they sift wheat, what do? They're trying to take the kernels, right, apart from the chaff. And they want to, and my understanding is you shake it on a grate or something, and the little pieces fall through, and you dispose of the rest of it. So what's Satan actually saying about Peter?
I'm separating Peter from Christ.
Okay, he's trying to separate him from Christ. He's trying to do, I can't help but compare it to Job, right? And then Job's the great parallel here. What was Satan trying to do with Job in Job chapter 1 and 2? What was he trying to prove?
That Job only followed Jesus because he was being blessed.
Yeah, and his belief, his accusation is what? He's not really faithful.
Yeah.
He doesn't really love you the way it seems. He only loves you because you're really good to him. And as soon as you take away these things, he's going to go. Right? And I think in a similar way, what Satan's trying to say about Peter is, Peter only follows you because of all these great things you're doing, right? Let me have a turn with him, and I'll show you who the real Peter is. And so this is a real testing ground for Peter. His faith, will he remain faithful or not? And that's going to be really important for Peter going forward. It's very important for the church, because of the good work Peter did afterwards. He was a significant worker in the kingdom. And so Jesus says, gives him this warning. Now, where's the sifting come? What sifting is he talking about?
When he denied Jesus.
Yeah, I think it's there in the courtyard. We'll talk more about it when we get there, but then this is when Peter really faces who he is, right? He's having to really face himself.
It also says something about Satan. Satan understands when you're at your weakest point. When you're distressed, you're in trouble, you don't understand, you're confused. It makes it real easy for him to slip in there and start whispering in your ear.
So Satan doesn't believe Peter is going to be faithful. However, the light in this passage, and it's a really bright light, is what Jesus says there in the middle of 32. When you have turned again, what's Jesus implying?
He's going to come back.
Yeah, he's implying two things. Number one, Peter, you're going to fall. And that's what he said. Before I get there, I prayed for you. I don't want to miss that. Jesus prayed for Peter, right, in a direct way. You can't help but think about, 1 John chapter 2, verse 1. I've written these things that you may not sin, but if we sin, what?
We have an advocate.
We have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ. Who is Peter's advocate?
Jesus.
Think about an advocate. That's the English translation of that term there. The Greek, my understanding is the Greek term in 1 John 2 is a lawyer, and it's translated advocate. But think about who is an advocate?
Somebody who defends
you. What's that?
Someone who defends you.
Somebody defends you?
Somebody speaks on your behalf.
Somebody speaks on your behalf.
And has reputation to elicit.
Has the credibility to speak up, right? But an advocate does more than just defend. They talk about the good things. If you're an advocate for a government program, are you just defending the program? You're going to talk about all the great things that program can do. So it's not just that Jesus is defending Peter, but I think more than that, he's lifting Peter up. And look at this great disciple of mine. And so Jesus says, I prayed for you. And then he goes on to say, and when, notice the determined language there. He's already determined, Jesus says in his head, when you, what, have turned again. That's another fancy way of saying repented, right? When you have repented and come back, you strengthen the brothers. I think this says two things. Number one, he has confidence in Peter's faith. It's not going to fail him. Ultimately, he's going to repent. And number two, what does he say? Strengthen your brothers. I still believe in you, Peter. I can only imagine what that would be for me. I can't get in Peter's shoes exactly. I don't know him that well, or I don't know what Scripture says, but I know how I would react if I failed, and I have many times. I have lots of examples. I would doubt myself in the future. Jesus doesn't doubt him. He says, you go and strengthen your brothers when you come back. To me, that's a powerful statement about the belief Jesus has in Peter. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say, if you go on with what the apostles even at this point, still thought was going to happen, that there was going to be a rebellion. They really don't think that Jesus is going to die. They think he's going to lead them in a rebellion. And so, in a way, they don't really think that, you know, anything bad, that something bad is going to happen. And then when it does, and all of a sudden Peter does look and sees, you know, Jesus over there, you know, being tried, then the fear comes on, and that's when he's more scared and says, oh, I don't know that guy. But then later, when Christ actually came back to life, that is when the apostles knew that it was a completely different game. And they knew, I think, before Jesus was crucified, they knew that he was a man of God. But I don't think they really thought he was the Son of God until he came back from the dead and knew, and they knew exactly who he was then. And then they were, I don't know, I don't want to say unstoppable, but there was no doubt whatsoever, again, about what they thought and what they were going to do for him. And when they started spreading the word, it was with 100% surety in what I'm saying. Because I was there, I saw him after he was crucified.
And the proof is of that is what happened. When 11 of the 12, or so add one after, what happened to them? They're all martyred for their faith. What does it take to give your life for a cause? I mean, that's a pretty big deal. I mean, somebody might sacrifice a lot of time, a lot of money, but when it comes to laying your life on the line, that's a step beyond what most human beings are willing to do. That's, you know, I'm always impressed with the guys who do Secret Service for the president. They make a determination that if there is something going to happen to the president, I will step in the way, I will take the bullet. And there are men who've done that. And it's amazing to me. That takes, and that level of dedication is beyond just simple, I support you, right? There's a different level of belief. And for the 11 of the 12, if all that is true to history, then they all died for their faith. That's an amazing thing. We know, without a doubt, that a couple of these, right, James, I think of Stephen, they died for their faith. Well, that says something about their confidence.
The interesting thing is that while Jesus was alive in the world, they had to worry about his health. They protected him. They made sure that he didn't get taken, he didn't get stolen, and so forth. But after he was dead and arose, now, here's a man who's come from the dead. Death has no more power in him. He is free of the fear of death, but he's already gone through it. And to some degree, that's the same way the apostles are in their martyrdom. While they were living, they understood, yeah, I'm going to die, but I know there's another side.
And we know they were afraid of his physical harm because of what they said earlier in the week, when after cleansing the temple, he went back, and what was their response? Thomas, I think, is the one who said it. He said, well, let us go die with him, right? That's what they thought. They did have an intent to protect his physical well-being. Good points, good stuff. So Luke gives us some extra things there, some more detail that I think helped to kind of show us a great picture. Now I'm going to go to John. John also doesn't write a lot, but he gives us a little bit of extra information. What I find interesting about John, of course, again, it's not a synoptic gospel. John written much later with different purposes in mind. Not that it in no way is opposes the other gospels. It is harmonious with it, but it just doesn't always include the same information. And so you get to John 13. Of course, John does not go through the Lord's Supper, institutional Lord's Supper. He gives us instead the cleansing, the feet cleansing. But if you go down to verse 36, I want you to read this a little bit here with me. Simon Peter said to them, Lord, where are you going? So he's giving us a little more background of where this conversation comes from. Jesus answered him, where I'm going, you cannot follow me now, but you will follow me afterwards. You remember, Jesus is talking about leaving, and they think he's going to go somewhere, like some other place. But he's not going to bring them, and they're worried about that. Peter said, verse 37, Peter said to him, Lord, why can I not follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. Jesus answered, you will lay down your life for me. Truly, truly, I say to you, the rooster will not crow till you have denied me three times. So that's that context. You've got a little bit more here. Now, what I find fascinating is you go just one verse later into chapter 14, and we'll read verses 1 through 6, but notice the context of the situation. What's it all based on? Well, it's based on what he just said about leaving and Peter denying him. Verse 1, let not your heart be troubled. Let not your heart be troubled about what? So maybe a couple different answers to that question, right? Number one, don't be troubled, I'm leaving. But also, what did you just tell Peter?
I'm going away.
You're going to deny me three times. Let not your heart be troubled. Believe it. Some translations have you believe in God. I think that's implied in the text, but the English standard says, believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prayer place for you? And if I go to prayer place for you, I will come again and take you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. And you know the way to where I'm going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way and the truth and life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you had known me, you would have known my Father also. From now on, you do know him and have seen him. So I think it's interesting. All of that, what happened in 14, is in the context of this very heavy conversation about their faithfulness or their lack thereof. He told all the disciples, you're going to scatter from me. And then he tells Peter directly, not only are you going to run away, but you're going to deny me three times before the morning even rises. And so just a very powerful moment here with the disciples. Now if you go on and continue looking at John, we're not going to do all that just for time's sake, but chapters 13 through into 17, verse 26, it are these final moments Jesus has with the disciples in this very intimate way. He gives them some encouragement, some instructions, some very important things that they needed to know. He's going to talk about the Holy Spirit, the Comforter, in this certain section, and how the Comforter is going to come to lead them to all truth. So he's giving them some kind of heavy instructions there as well as encouragement. But I'll let you go and spend some time studying that. Any questions about it, though? You can come Thursday morning to our Bible study. We're going to dig deep into that stuff when we get there. That's your encouragement to come to my class. But let's go on to the next slide here. Okay, so as we are now Thursday evening leading, Friday their evening leading into their late into their night on Friday. So as we continue our thoughts here, Jesus will transition to the Garden of Gethsemane. Now again, we probably need to do a couple different things here. In Matthew 26, verse 30, Matthew lets us know that they leave from the evening meal to go to the garden to pray. I want you to note something in Luke Luke 22:39, just to kind of reemphasize what we were talking about earlier. Luke 22:39, Luke says, and he came out and went as was his what?
Custom.
Now, why is that significant? Well, number one, if we're going to talk about prayer, I mean, it's a custom of Jesus to pray, but from the context of understanding what's going on, why is it significant? Judas knew exactly where to find it, because this is where he was all the time. He'd set this pattern in place, and it would have been easy for Judas to know where he was. So that's kind of important to note. So let's look at the prayer here. Matthew and Mark are pretty much the same. Their wording is very, very similar. So let's go to Mark this time. Let's look at Mark chapter 14, just to get a different gospel point of view here. Mark 14 and verse 32. Somebody want to help my voice and read 32. It's a little lengthy, but 242.
They came to a place named Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here until I have prayed." And he took with him Peter and James and John, and began to be very distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is deeply grieved to the point of death. Remain here and keep watch." And he went a little beyond them and fell to the ground and began to pray, that if it were possible, the hour might pass him by. And he was saying, "Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will." And he came and found them sleeping and said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not keep watch for 1 hour? Keep watching and praying that you may not come into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Again, he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again, he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? It is enough. The hour has come. Behold, the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Get up. Let us be going. Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand."
Okay, so you've got them going out to this mountain top, this hill. Let's see. I want to show you. Okay, so this is an artistic rendition of what they think it would look like. Is you have the Mount of Olives. There are actually three mounds up here. One of them's not pictured, but where he was probably on one of those three mounds there, which was probably an olive garden. This picture here, this one gives you kind of a look from the city out, so just keep this in mind. I'll come back to it in a minute, but you can see the different paths going out to the orchard. This one, you can see those three summits. And so this is modern day, of course, but you can kind of visualize you're high up, pretty high elevated there, being able to see very well. Would have also been, though, a very kind of secluded place to go and spend some quiet time.
Do you know, is that public land, like a park or something, or like does somebody privately own it?
I have no idea. Good question.
Now it's like, there's several gardens there, and what I saw was mainly like churches, like old churches that
you can see now.
So
religious people,
you have church and then olive garden, and that's what was amazing. Those olive trees, some of them were 2,000 years old, but they're still there.
Yeah, so that just kind of gives you an idea. This, of course, this has changed over time, but there are those three peaks. Hard to know exactly which one he would have been on. All right, so if I go back. Come on. Okay, so let's go back into the garden here. Matthew does give you a little bit longer spelling out of the prayer in Matthew 26 and verse 39. There he says, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." It's interesting that in Matthew's, in the translation of Matthew, they have "my Father," whereas in Mark's, they have "Abba Father." Similar statement, but it's just, it's an endearing statement. Your Abba, your Father, speaking to the closeness of the two. Matthew, he says, "If it be possible, let this cup pass from me, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." Again, speaking to Jesus' faithfulness, even in a very difficult situation. Now, he goes, now, also something else that's kind of fascinating, if you go into John's Gospel again, the prayer that John records actually doesn't, he records a lot of different information. He actually doesn't record this particular part of his prayer. He records the prayer that Jesus has, which indicates when Jesus goes there, it's not just a short kind of two-sentence prayer or paragraph, but it's a lot longer dissertation. Or not dissertation, but conversation between him and God. And if you go to John 16, 17, you can read that and look at, I think it's chapter 17, gets into his prayer. Much longer. But here, again, he has this prayer to God. He pours out his heart. If you go to Luke's Gospel again, Luke gives us a similar wording as far as the prayer goes, but then a couple interesting things to note that I'm fascinated with that you don't find in Matthew and Mark's Gospel. Go to Luke 22:43. Now, as he's praying, Luke records, "And there appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat became like drops of great drops of blood falling down to the ground." Now, in Matthew and Mark, he says to them, "Come pray with me." Why? I'm in deep distress, even unto death. Right? And so that's the way Mark and Matthew describe his emotional state. Well, Luke gives us not just a statement of his deep emotion, but actual symbol of it, which is these drops of blood. Now, and there's, of course, debate on whether this was an actual thing where he's sweating blood, or if the writer's just trying to indicate to us that the agony, the sweat was so heavy. Now, whichever way, I don't think it changes the text. It doesn't change the intensity. I do think it's interesting. Luke was a physician, which would be well knowledgeable about medical procedures, and it is quite possible for somebody to do this, where you can be in such deep concentration that you can, I guess, bust capillaries, I think that's the right terminology there, in your forehead and cause this reaction. Either way, though, I think the point of this is the agony that he is going through, the deep concentration and sorrow he's having to deal with. There's also another symbol of this in this text. What is it? Another, just really fascinating. Luke is the only one who gives us these two details. His blood, his sweat becoming like blood. And what's the other thing?
An angel.
Now, this isn't the only time an angel's come to strengthen Jesus. We actually see this two other times. You might tell me the two other times we've seen angels strengthening him.
Temptation.
After the temptation, Matthew chapter 4, right afterwards, an angel came to strengthen him. And double check on this. I almost speak out of turn. No, I don't think an angel was there. Matthew 17, the transfiguration. I know Moses, it was Moses and Elijah. So it wasn't an angel, but it was Moses and Elijah. And the text tells us that they were there speaking about his death. So we have seen in the life of Jesus a couple times where God's either used angels or others souls to come give him strength and encouragement. Fascinating. Part of the text, but here's an angel of God strengthening him to deal with this upcoming, these upcoming events that he's going to have to endure.
The other thing that's interesting to me is that sometimes we don't give credit to the fact, we talk about Jesus being crucified and understand the pain and suffering he went through, but that pain and suffering started a long time, really, hours before the actual event itself.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think it goes all the way back to, you've seen different times throughout his ministry how he's been distressed at different times and usually had to deal with people's lack of faith. But if you go back to the dinner, I mean, that with Judas, that had to be a tough emotional thing for him. Here's one of his close disciples, whom he calls a friend later on, who's going to betray him. I mean, the emotional toil of what he's had to deal with has already been pretty great. And then, of course, the physical will come later, but there's lots of things that have happened here. All right, I probably just have to stop here. I want to come back and look at the betrayal itself and what happened. This is one of those we're really going to have to, as we've been doing it, as we look at this gospel, look at the different information that it included so we can get a fuller picture of what actually happened. And that's what we'll try to do next week. Thank you again so much for being here and taking part in the study. We'll be dismissed from this class and join for a devotional in just a couple of minutes. Thank you.